Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Public Health Grand Rounds at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. I am Ruth Katz, the very, very proud dean of the School of Public Health. Today's Grand Round session is being co-sponsored with GW's HIV/AIDS Institute. As many of you know, the Institute is a joint initiative of the Public Health School and the University's School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Its goal is to connect faculty members in the D.C. region as they work to turn the tide of the HIV/AIDS epidemic through research, education, prevention, and clinical care. We are delighted to have the Institute's support today because cross-cutting partnerships are essential to moving knowledge into practice, and that is exactly the concept around which we have built our second annual Grand Rounds. This year's theme is translating science into public health policy. This is the seventh of nine sessions, and if you have been able to join us before, you know how stimulating each one of them has been. Julie Gerberding, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, kicked off the series in September by exploring health politics and health policy. At other sessions, national experts helped to answer thought-provoking questions such as, why should people with health insurance care about people without it? How can we make policy decisions about chemical risks in the face of uncertainty? How can we reduce health disparities? What should we do to promote physical activity among young people? There are no easy answers, of course, but in each talk, our speakers have reminded us that the primary goal of public health research is to generate results that are relevant to real-world problems. We care about that very deeply at this school because we are trying to shape health policy and inform the law, identify best practices, and influence the structure and financing of the healthcare system. I can absolutely assure you that today's speaker, Dr. Kevin DeCock, who directs the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization, is fully committed to these goals. We are honored that Dr. DeCock is with us today to talk about science and public health policy in the context of the maturing HIV/AIDS epidemic. To adapt to that epidemic, we need the expertise of many disciplines. But that's so in most areas of public health, and it is one reason we issue an open invitation to our Grand Round series. Today's audience includes students and faculty in the public health and medical schools and throughout this university, but it also draws residents in the greater D.C. region. By joining us today, each of you acknowledges the very real important role that public health plays in your own lives and in the lives of your community. We hope you will attend future Grand Rounds whenever you can. Our next event is scheduled for March 25th at noon in this auditorium. We will hear then from Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta. Dr. Gupta is president of the International Center for Research on Women, and she will be speaking to us about reproductive health. As we get started today, I want to express my deep gratitude to Pfizer, Inc. for the support that makes Grand Rounds possible. Without Dr. Barbara DeBono, who has been Pfizer's champion for the series, we simply would not be able to do this. We are also indebted to the Kaiser Family Foundation for helping us to webcast and podcast the entire series so that we can share it with a much wider audience. Thanks to the Foundation's generosity, you can download any Grand Rounds event you wish, log on to the school's website for access, as well as to check up on upcoming events. And now, without further ado, it is my very great pleasure to turn the microphone and the program over to Dr. Alan Greenberg, who co-directs the GW HIV/AIDS Institute with Dr. Gary Simon, who is also here today. He also serves as chair of the school's Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. And finally, I know he is a very good friend and longtime colleague of Dr. DeCock, and is very much responsible for having him join us today. Dr. Greenberg.
Thank you, Dean Katz. I have the great honor of introducing our guest speaker today, my friend and colleague, Dr. Kevin DeCock. Dr. DeCock is the director of the HIV/AIDS Department of the World Health Organization in Geneva, overseeing WHO's mission to achieve universal access to HIV prevention, care, and treatment throughout the world. Previously, Dr. DeCock served as director of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at CDC and director of CDC's field stations in Côte d'Ivoire and in Kenya. A world-renowned expert in infectious disease epidemiology, notably HIV and tuberculosis, Dr. De Kock is truly a global public health citizen. He was born in Belgium, is American by nationality, has a family residence in Kenya, currently lives in Switzerland, and received his graduate training in England, in medicine at the University of Bristol, and in tropical medicine at Liverpool University. He is a visiting professor of medicine and international health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He has co-authored more than 250 publications in the peer-reviewed literature, served on the editorial boards of prestigious journals such as AIDS, The Lancet, and the New England Journal of Medicine, and is a recipient of numerous awards for his contributions to public health. I first met Dr. De Kock in 1986, when we were two of the first, if not the first two, Epidemic Intelligence Service officers sent by CDC to the Congo, now called Zaire, then called Zaire, to help investigate what was then the newly identified HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa. I was impressed by his epidemiologic acumen, his oratory skills, and above all by his profound commitment to combating the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the developing world. In 1993, when I succeeded him as director of CDC's HIV field research station in Abidjan, I recall a speech in which he stated, to paraphrase, that there were three essential qualities needed by successful leaders in the field of HIV/AIDS: a sound mind, a compassionate heart, and a strong backbone. Kevin, in your career, you have clearly demonstrated that you possess each of these qualities, and as a result, you have served as a leading advocate for equity in the global response to AIDS and as a mentor for numerous scientists around the world. On behalf of the GW Public Health and Medical Communities, please accept our gratitude for agreeing to speak today in the Public Health Grand Round series. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Kevin De Kock.
Well, good afternoon, and Dean Katz and Alan, thank you very much for those excessively kind words of introduction. It's a real pleasure. It's a real pleasure to be here, and an honor at this very prestigious school. And as has been said, Alan and I go back more years than we care to remember. And I just want to acknowledge that that friendship actually has been quite important in my own career. Anyway, a great pleasure to be here. What I'd like to do in the next 45 minutes or so, with about 59 slides, which as always is too many, is start with just a few comments of reflections on our situation, say a few words about the origins of the epidemic, review global epidemiology, talk about the impact of the AIDS pandemic and some reasons for its extraordinary heterogeneity, and then talk about the public health response before finishing with some comments about the future. Reflections. I'm actually a clinician by background, an internist, but in epidemiology, in the same way that I think microbiology may be described as the basic science of infectious diseases, epidemiology is the basic science of public health, and surveillance is a core public health discipline. A former CDC director, Bill Foege, used to say also famously that if that's the basic science, the philosophic basis of public health is social justice. Science should drive how we respond to public health problems. In the history of the AIDS epidemic, early on, this infectious disease was treated very differently from some other infectious diseases, but that exceptional way that AIDS has been considered is actually being eroded, as I'll briefly discuss. And in a way, it's health itself that's becoming an exceptional issue in global affairs. Nonetheless, I think that HIV does remain the leading challenge in global health. And finally, and this is not a political statement with all this talk of change and hope, nonetheless, change is an absolute inevitability in our work. You don't need to call for it. It actually happens, whether you like it or not. And at the same time, I think medicine and public health are profoundly pragmatic subjects. I think pragmatism is an undervalued attribute. And I think in medicine and in public health, hope is a good companion, but not always a good guide. Since this is a school, and I assume that many people here are considerably younger than I, I think anybody who's under the age of 35 probably does not remember a time when AIDS did not exist. The disease was first recognized in 1981. Since when, there have been more than 60 million HIV infections and more than 25 million AIDS deaths, mostly affecting people that we know nothing about. An aphorism I like, which is relevant to surveillance, is that those who go uncounted all too easily count for nothing. But this is actually an extraordinary phenomenon in global health. There's good evidence now that, mainly from laboratory and molecular studies, that the origin of HIV-1 is the chimpanzee. These phylogenetic trees show a couple of important points. In red are a very sensitive pointer. Oops. I don't think I'm going to be able to use this pointer. In red, you see the in red the chimpanzee different chimpanzee viruses. In black, the human viruses, the three different types of HIV-1. And there's two things that are remarkable. One is that these different HIV-1 isolates are actually closer to the chimpanzee viruses than they are to each other. And secondly, that some of these, two of the, on that slide, two of the human viruses are actually interspersed amongst the phylogenetic representations of the chimp viruses, indicating that the human virus is closely related to the chimpanzee virus. And secondly, that there must have been at least three different episodes of cross-species transmission to establish this infection in humans. And there's different lines of evidence that suggest this likely happened. We can't be certain, but likely happened around the 1930s. The first human isolate that we know about, the first human infection that we know about based on a blood specimen, came from the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in 1959. So the HIV-1, that group M that causes the global pandemic, comes from the species of chimpanzee, or subspecies Pan troglodytes troglodytes, whose home is there in the pink part of Central Africa. And I think that really this chimpanzee origin and that geographic origin is largely beyond much questioning. But the relevance of all of this, I think you can say, well, does it really matter where this came from? In some ways, no. What really matters is what we do about it. On the other hand, I think it would be most unwise if you were the person on CNN who was, you know, saying, well, more than 60 million HIV infections, more than 25 million deaths, and it really doesn't matter how this happened, where it came from. I don't think you want to be the person saying that. It's really the archetypal example of an emerging infectious disease, of which, of course, there have been more than 30 over the last 20 to 30 years or so. I think one of the things that explains all of this as well, and this is a slide I borrowed from Roy Anderson from Imperial College, is it's remarkable how much our world has changed in such a very, very short period of time. Homo sapiens, as we know him or her, probably has existed for about 10,000 generations. But when you look at, when you consider human travel and how that has changed, it's really changed remarkably over very, very few generations. This is a slide from England showing four generations where the great-grandfather really was restricted to his rural villages and didn't travel very far at all. The grandfather made it as far as London. The father made it across the English Channel during the Second World War and got to Southern Europe. And of course, the son is a global traveler. And if you think of exposure to human pathogens and what this does to the distribution of infectious disease and to exposure to infectious disease and the sorts of pressures from an evolutionary perspective that this puts on us as well as on the pathogens themselves, it really is quite remarkable. But it's certainly, when you put all these things together, the spread of the AIDS pandemic is both plausible, understandable, and really quite remarkable. I use this slide a lot to discuss how we measure the AIDS pandemic, and I'll use it again later in the talk when we talk about the public health response. The flow of water through that open faucet represents new infections with HIV, and the rate of flow indicates incidence, the rate of number of new infections per unit population, per unit time. That first receptacle represents people living with HIV. We measure that, we describe that usually as a prevalence. With the passage of time and CD4 decline, they develop immunodeficiency, the disease we recognize as AIDS, the outflow, the incidence of AIDS, the final receptacle, people living with AIDS, and the final outflow, people dying from AIDS. And each of these is actually measurable. Obviously, the one that matters the most is incidence, to turn off that faucet, if we could do it. It's estimated in a collaborative work by UNAIDS and WHO that these estimates, and they're called estimates because they're estimates, these estimates were published late last year in November. There's about 33.2 million people living with HIV. In 2007, about 2.5 million new infections, and in that year, about 2.1 million deaths. This infection, as you know, is very unequally distributed. Sub-Saharan Africa, which represents 10 or 11% of the world's population, accounts for over two-thirds of global HIV infections, and each other regions of the world, you know, less than 15%. Asia, 14%. The Americas, about 11%. The United States, very substantially the most heavily affected country in the industrialized world. This slide shows the estimated prevalence in adults between the ages of 15 and 49, and it shows a couple of important points. Firstly, that global prevalence has been stable since the early part of this century. It's estimated to be about 0.8%. And in Africa, prevalence peaked around the turn of the century, and there has been a gradual decline since then. But these curves, of course, hide tremendous variation by country and region. In terms of incidence, people newly infected, as I said, estimated at about 2.5 million, incidence likely peaked in the late 1990s and globally has been declining since then. And finally, estimates of AIDS mortality, around 2.1 million annually. We see that the estimates in the last 2 years show a decline. I think we have to believe those, because if you think there are now between 2 and 3 million people globally on antiretroviral therapy, you cannot have that many people on therapy and not have some kind of impact on AIDS deaths. I think while these trends have become more evident, I think it's also possible now to characterize epidemiology better into some generalizations that I think apply and are likely to apply for the immediate and midterm future. We really have two sort of diametrically opposed patterns. Countries of sub-Saharan Africa, not all of sub-Saharan Africa, but most of southern Africa, to a lesser extent East Africa, suffering epidemics that one describes as generalized, epidemics that are self-sustaining in the general population. Africa accounting for 68% of incidence and prevalence, 3/4 of AIDS mortality, 90% of AIDS in children. Remarkably, there's 8 countries in southern Africa that account for about 1/3 of global HIV infections, and about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 people living with HIV worldwide actually lives in South Africa. In contrast, in the rest of the world, the epidemic is concentrated in specific groups at risk: injecting drug users, men who have sex with men, commercial sex workers, and the clients and partners of such persons. Obviously, clusters of infection can occur, but generalized epidemics seem to be unlikely. The area of the world most heavily affected after Africa is the Caribbean. Haiti, actually, the single most heavily affected country. But in the Caribbean as a whole, prevalence is only about 1%. Now, do you believe these data? Do you believe these estimates? And how do we go about measuring them? In countries with generalized epidemics, probably the most important source of data are measurements of prevalence in pregnant women attending antenatal clinics. Those data are then used to extrapolate with a whole bunch of corrections to estimates for the general population. But in recent time, there's been a greater emphasis on household surveys, random large surveys, demographic and health surveys incorporating HIV testing, which have given another estimate of another source of estimates, and actually have tended to downsize the epidemic. In countries with concentrated epidemics, it's necessary to estimate the size of the specific groups at risk. For example, how many injecting drug users in a particular country, and then use prevalence data from those sentinel populations. Of course, the parameter we really would like to know is incidence, so how many new infections are occurring, but to measure that directly is extremely difficult, and I could come back to that in later discussion if necessary, but our estimates of incidence are difficult. This is an important slide, which illustrates a couple of concepts, and these are modeled data of their deductions from real data in Zimbabwe, where prevalence has been declining, as it has been in a number of African countries. The scale on the right of the slide shows incidence and mortality. The scale on the left is prevalence. The red, you see a red curve, a blue curve, and then a black curve. And what you see is incidence rising, peaking. Incidence peaks before prevalence, which is the blue curve, which itself peaks before mortality. And what you see is that when incidence and mortality equal out, in other words, deaths, each death being replaced by one new infection, you end up with stable prevalence. Mortality obviously drives prevalence down, high incidence drives it up, and of course if you introduce into this mixture antiretroviral therapy, which stops people from dying, you could actually do quite well with prevention and reduce it, but you actually may end up with a higher prevalence because people are not dying. So it is a complicated series of interactions between incidence, prevalence, and mortality that determines exactly where we are. The situation in Africa, as you all know, is really quite unique. This slide summarizes some of the sort of core impact issues, tremendous family, social, and demographic disruption within southern Africa, in countries like Botswana or Swaziland, Lesotho, and countries like that, literally decades of life expectancy lost. If Swaziland, probably a very small country, where actually there has been a decline in population. That was thought to be pretty much impossible. It is, and I'm not sure it's happened anywhere else, but in Swaziland, life expectancy now 32. An epidemic of orphans, the economic effects that are particularly concentrated at the family and household level. In some places, particularly southern Africa, an interaction with worsening food security, the effect on public services, including hospitals filled with patients with advanced AIDS, healthcare staff themselves affected. many interacting issues that actually have led some, including the United Nations, to describe this as a threat to stability and security in these heavily affected areas, and very importantly, a massive effect on another very important public health issue, that of tuberculosis. This slide shows some trends over the last, since the 1980s, the last 20 years or so, of tuberculosis in a number of African countries. The highest rates at the top of the slide, with 600 per 100,000 per year or so in some southern African countries, are rates that are more than 100 times what the incidence of tuberculosis is in the United States. Added to this mix now is a really quite worrying situation concerning drug resistance, and particularly multi-drug resistance. Multi-drug resistance defined as resistance to at least rifampin and isoniazid, the two most important therapies, most important drugs in standard tuberculosis therapy, and also the emergence and of extensively drug resistant, which is defined as MDR plus resistance to some of the second line agents, resistance to the quinolones, and at least one of the injectables, making this in some situations really almost incurable tuberculosis. Now this slide, I just took it from a report that, from a press release actually, that associated with a report that WHO, the Stop TB program, launched I think last week or the week before. But really a very concerning situation that in some countries, thinking of countries like in Eastern Europe, like Latvia, over 20% of new cases of tuberculosis actually being MDR. As far as XDR and MDR are concerned in Africa, apart from South Africa, we have very few data. But the situation in South Africa is really quite a cause for concern. And this is, I think, one of the gravest and perhaps one of the most uncertain aspects for the future. Jim Curran, who used to head the AIDS program at CDC and is a good colleague of Alan's and myself, I saw him last week at a meeting, and with his typical way with words, he said if there was one thing that could turn the AIDS epidemic into a pseudo-SARS epidemic, it would be the spread of XDR. And you can just imagine an American Peace Corps volunteer or somebody like that working in South Africa or something, coming back to the United States, having XDR, spreading it to a family member and so on. And this is really this is a serious situation. And I think I am concerned that we're actually not really geared up to deal with this. Again, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. One could devote a whole lecture to it. Why do we have this extraordinary difference in the AIDS epidemic around the world? Why is Africa and Southern Africa the way it is? Now, I think there's two ways to look at it. If you take your epidemiology 101, I presume that you will hear about agent, host, and environment and the way these interact. And indeed, qualitatively, I think that's a very helpful way of thinking about it. If you want to be more mathematical about it, it's to think about what's called the basic reproductive rate, which is the number of secondary cases that are generated by one primary case. If you look at each red dot on that slide with successive generations of transmission, for an epidemic to spread, each primary case must infect more than one other case. If each case results in less than one other transmission, the epidemic will fade away. And for HIV, the basic reproductive rate depends on the rate of partner change, transmissibility, and the duration of infectiousness. And really, it is in the interaction of these features that one should be able to describe epidemiology. If only it was as easy as that. This slide, and again, I took these from Roy Anderson. This slide shows incidence curves, the principal slide, the part of the slide, incidence curves with a very high basic reproductive rate going across to a lower basic reproductive rate. So if you look at San Francisco in the late 1970s and early 1980s, must have looked like one of those curves on the left with a very brisk explosive epidemic, but then peaking quite quickly coming down, but note, not going back to baseline. In the box inside the slide, you see the curve of prevalence of people living with HIV. And that is what the curve looks like in the United States. Now, that's got very serious implications because, yes, it goes up, it comes down, but you see this very long tail. The implications of that are several. Firstly, in terms of trying to impact on this, we obviously have to try and interrupt that very brisk upslope, but we also have to try and bring that long tail down. But it also means that once you have an epidemic, you're in this for the very long haul. I think what not enough attention is given to the fact that, I mean, this is what it looks like in a country like the United States, but this is what it's going to look like in the developing world as well. In other words, we're in this for very, you know, for the very long term, and it is frustrating that I don't know if anybody in this room will really know how this story ever ends, because it's likely that it'll still be going on by the time the youngest person here leaves this earth. Several studies have been done trying to tease out why, rates are so high in some of these countries compared to others. And frustratingly, really only a couple of factors have come out. One is the prevalence of herpes simplex infection, genital herpes, herpes type 2, which facilitates not only the acquisition of HIV, but also its transmission. These are the results of a meta-analysis some years ago now, showing a doubling of the relative risk in acquiring HIV infection in patients infected with HSV2. And the second biological mechanism, risk factor, was circumcision status. If you just look at the top part of the slide, again, these are data from meta-analysis, from observational and analytic studies, looking at circumcision status, showing that men who were circumcised men who were circumcised had an approximate halving of risk of becoming infected. The bottom three bars, the summary relative risks from three interventional trials published over the last couple of years from South Africa, Kenya, and Uganda, remarkably consistent with those observational data. Now, you know, kind of amazingly, those two biological factors are all that has come out. And it's been very difficult to show, although obviously for individuals, behavioral risk is very important at the individual level, it's been very difficult to show any substantial differences in behavior across different societies as explaining any of these epidemiologic differences. The journalist Helen Epstein wrote this book, The Invisible Cure, in which she discussed in detail the role of concurrent partnerships, that is, sexual relationships with more than one partner at the same time. And it is certainly very plausible and convincing, I think, that if you have a society where concordant partnerships are the norm, rather than sequential monogamy, even if the total number of partners is the same, concurrent partnerships set up a network for the diffusion of infection through a society. And I think that's plausible. It's very difficult to study epidemiologically. The rest of the slide if you accept that, and you accept, you know, herpes, which obviously itself is an STI, the role of lack of male circumcision, which is the norm in Southern Africa, and concurrent partnerships, which again are very frequent. What actually explains all of that? Well, I think one of the, I should acknowledge a Zimbabwean colleague now working in South Africa, John Holdgrave, who discussed this in some detail. Obviously, the AIDS epidemic is embedded in social, political, anthropological, and historical context. And one of the things that dominates Southern Africa was massive migration for work, particularly men migrating to South Africa to work in the gold mines and other mines. And it's captured brilliantly. I If I had been really clever, I would have played you a clip from it, but my computer skills are not up to that. But it's captured brilliantly in a song by the South African trumpeter Hugh Masakela, who has a song called Coal Train. And the lyrics are, there's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi, from Zambia and Zimbabwe, from Angola and Mozambique. This train carries young and old African men to work in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg. And that massive migration that has affected, in which have participated hundreds of thousands, if not millions of men, undoubtedly has profoundly influenced epidemiology of STDs, HIV, and also tuberculosis. So that's epidemiology. Now, what about public health interventions? And again, I think this cartoon is rather useful, because if you think about it, we need to stop people being exposed to HIV. You can walk down this cascade in the same way. We need to stop them getting exposed. If they get exposed, we need to stop them from getting infected. If they get infected, we need to stop them from getting sick. If they get sick, we have to stop them from dying. And if they have to die, we should at least stop them from dying young. It shows the inextricable link between prevention, treatment, and care, and that if you're going to address this whole epidemic, you really do have to take it from the top to the bottom. And I think that has been one of the advances in recent years, that a determination to have a truly comprehensive response. I guess that the vision that we work under was enunciated by the leaders of the G8, shown on this slide, who, when they met at Gleneagles in 2005, issued this statement that WHO, UNAIDS, and other international bodies should develop and implement a package of HIV prevention, treatment, and care with the aim of as close as possible to universal access to all who need it by 2010. Two comments. One, as close as possible, the weasel words. The weasel words, the let-out clause. And secondly, if you want to think about change, you could walk down this group of people and, you know, say, Wolfowitz, gone. Kofi Annan, gone. Some others going. WHO in its work uses these five strategic directions to guide our work for the health sector. And WHO is responsible for the health sector and not for the other elements that form an essential aspect of dealing with AIDS. Expanding testing and counseling, maximizing prevention, accelerating treatment scale-up, strengthening health systems, and all of that guided by and evaluated by the appropriate strategic information. And let me just talk about each of these in a few words. We have a problem with HIV testing. If there's a problem about, if there's an emergency about access to antiretroviral therapy, then there certainly is an emergency about testing, because you can't get put on therapy if you don't know you're HIV infected. And even in the industrialized world, all is not well. In the United States, about 25% of HIV-infected people are not aware of their HIV status. And yet we know, obviously, that is necessary to access treatment. We also know that people who know that they are HIV-infected, that the majority of them will do their best not to transmit to others. In the UK and in France, it's about a third of infected people who don't know it. And in these countries, just as in the United States, about a third or 40% of people who are diagnosed at a time when their CD4 count is already 200 or below. And in the developing world, and these are a number of African countries, it's much lower knowledge of status, serous status. Less than 20% of people in Africa have been tested for HIV and received their results. And this is a problem because not only can you not access therapy, but if you're diagnosed late, you do badly. In a comparison from the ArtLink collaboration, a comparison of treatment outcomes in the North and the South, people in the low-income settings, 73% of deaths occurred in people starting therapy at a CD4 count below 100, and almost 40% of the deaths occurred in the first month, 80% in the first 4 months, indicating people are being diagnosed late. I think two sets of recommendations that really are important, and I think, can and should lead to substantial change. Are these the guidelines from the recommendations from the CDC published in September of 2006, and then analogous, somewhat different, but analogous recommendations by WHO and UNAIDS on what we call provider-initiated HIV testing and counseling, that is basically testing in healthcare settings for global guidance. Moving on to prevention, I think this actually may be a slide that I borrowed from Alan. We all obviously hope for the intervention that will do it. And the pendulum of enthusiasm for biomedical interventions swings backwards and forwards, and gosh, it's swung to the negative side rather impressively in the last 12 to 18 months. I think everybody's familiar with the very disappointing, indeed disturbing, results of the Merck vaccine trial. Several negative trials of microbicides, a negative trial published in The Lancet of cervical diaphragms, negative trials of suppressive therapy with acyclovir for HSV2, really male circumcision, the only good news, waiting to hear about pre-exposure prophylaxis, which I am more hopeful about, although it'll be a difficult intervention to use if the trials are positive, and uncertainty about the role of antiretroviral therapy or the effect of antiretroviral therapy in lowering transmission, perhaps most important for discordant couples. But again, we can come back to that later. And yet we do have interventions that work, and a lot of them we've had for a very long time, which leads us to the question, if we have these interventions, how can it be that we have this extraordinarily severe epidemic? Here are data actually from Abidjan, from our group collectively in Abidjan. On the right of the slide, rates of HIV in sex workers, in new cohorts of sex workers coming to a clinic, a sex worker clinic that we established, showing an impressive decline in the rates of HIV infection. And similar data actually available from Kinshasa several years earlier, and also from Thailand. And so a good intervention for core groups with potential lessons for the general population. In terms of male circumcision, these recommendations were issued last year, about a year ago now, end of March last year, following the release of those trials. This is really probably most relevant, if not only relevant, to southern and, to a lesser extent, East Africa, where populations are large, prevalence is high, rates of circumcision, at least in southern Africa, are low. This could have a very substantial impact, but it takes a long time. And it is not as easy as it sounds, obviously. But, a 60%, almost 60% reduction in the risk of HIV infection in men, that's not something for a once-only biomedical intervention. That's not something you get every day. And I sort of feel as an extraordinary responsibility to try and use this, because prevention science has, has quite often been rather discouraging. And yet it is a complicated issue, and there is progress, but it's slow. Drug users, we have, I think, quite good interventions for drug users. Harm reduction is capable of blunting epidemics in drug users, even reversing them sometimes. There's a list that I won't read of the components of harm reduction. In red, what is delivered through the health sector has been impressively used in a limited number of settings, but in general across the world, services for drug users are woefully inadequate, and their access to therapy also is inadequate. The reason I'm actually in Washington, apart from this opportunity at GW today, is to attend a meeting of the Interagency Task Team on Mother-to-Child Transmission Prevention. Of course, one of the spectacular successes in the industrialized world, but difficult to implement in Africa for a number of reasons. The UN approach to PMTCT is based on four prongs: the primary prevention of HIV in young women, the prevention of unwanted pregnancy, prevention of mother-to-child transmission itself, and then appropriate treatment and care. One of the frustrating and difficult issues is how to make breastfeeding safer. I think some other priorities that we really need to do better with is optimizing diagnosis and treatment for infants who are highly at risk of dying early on. 50% of children with HIV in Africa die before the age of 2. Defining the optimal regimens for pregnant women and operationalizing all of this. And again, it's been disappointing that we have not done better, but I'm hopeful that there will be some progress. This shows the difficult situation concerning breastfeeding. The painting on the left is rather poignantly called The Unhappy Mother. It's from a museum in Antwerp. On the right, what you see is rates of gastroenteritis in women who wean early. Early weaning, a potential strategy, we hoped, to prevent breastfeeding transmission, which does account for about 40% of all HIV infection transmitted from mother to child. And yet, that early weaning at 6 months associated with what, you know, pediatricians will tell you they always knew, that in developing countries, if women don't breastfeed, that there'll be growth faltering and high rates of gastroenteritis and other infectious diseases. There are some encouraging data, and they were presented recently at CROI, and they include data from our group, the CDC group in Kisumu in Kenya, that different approaches, including the use of combination antiretroviral therapy through the breastfeeding period, can actually lead to reduced transmission. And it will be interesting to see how these research data get translated into policy, and that's a fascinating area of how much data you need to make some global decisions. I think one, as far as moving on, one of the very frustrating and difficult issues in prevention is the whole situation concerning men who have sex with men. If you care to have a look at it, Harold Jaffe, another ex-CDC colleague, and a couple of others, myself included, published this in JAMA in December of last year, discussing the very troublesome re-emergence of HIV in men who have sex with men. These are data from the UK, the orange trend, the orange curve showing HIV reports. It is remarkable. I think we face a double crisis concerning MSM. Firstly, the situation in the industrialized world, it is remarkable that, you know, 27 years into the AIDS epidemic, with everything we know, it's almost amongst MSM as if nothing has changed, in that HIV remains a reality in the lives of gay men and men who have sex with men in a way that is really quite astonishing. And I think one of the issues is that the sense of community, of a community defending itself against this public health threat, that seems to have dissipated for a number of reasons, and one could discuss that at great length. But I think this situation is a true public health challenge that we're not meeting. The other aspect of the crisis is that MSM in developing countries have all been kind of neglected. But if you look in any society, of course you find men who have sex with men. And when you do look, they have high rates of HIV infection. And these are data from Thailand, but there are now data coming out of Africa as well. And it's been quite a neglected issue. Speeding up a bit and moving on to treatment, our third strategic priority. These are data published last year relating to end 2006. About 28% of people who need therapy, who need ART globally, were receiving it. 28% in Africa. Actually means there are now more people in Africa on ART than anywhere else in the world. However, in dark brown is the unmet need, and of course the unmet need in Africa is also the very greatest. How are we doing? This scale-up is great. It's truly encouraging. But we shouldn't delude ourselves about some of the problems. And there are two problems I want to point out. One is you see this very high mortality early on. And this compares mortality in the north, in the south, in the developing world, compared with the industrialized world. Overall, the mortality is about twice as high. And you see it's concentrated early on. When we do these kinds of analyses, the clock starts ticking when people access drug. And yet that's a mistake, because actually, if you look before that, between diagnosis or lack of diagnosis, between first illness and accessing drug, there is a very great mortality. So actually there's a couple of challenges. It's not only that we're diagnosing people late, but it's even worse than we thought, because a lot of people aren't getting onto therapy in the first place. The other issue is retention in therapy. And although early indications were quite encouraging, adherence is good, but there is a substantial loss to follow-up. And when you investigate what happens, some die, but some don't, and some stop treatment for all kinds of social and systems reasons. This is an article published in PLOS Medicine last year, giving a systematic review, and there is a major cause for concern here. When WHO did an analysis of the treatment effort, the so-called 3x5 program, but it's the same when you look at the president's emergency plan, the single biggest obstacle is actually the weakness of health systems. And health systems, the six bars on the left, are what WHO considers the essential elements of a health system. A health system defined as all organizations, people, and actions whose primary intent is to promote, restore, or maintain health. But the issues in these countries of human resources, of infrastructure, lab capacity, et cetera, is the major challenge, clearly. Let me skip that. And finally, strategic information. Margaret Chan, the Director General of WHO, repeatedly says, what gets measured gets done. And Jim Curran, again, said to me on numerous occasions, surveillance is the conscience of any epidemic. A few months ago, I was reading the New York Times online, and I read an article about an investigation in New York State of, I think it was an outbreak of hepatitis C in a doctor's practice who was reusing needles or vials. And I read this article and I highlighted something that struck me. With only 70 epidemiologists working for the state of New York, their role in safeguarding the public health is considered indispensable. And I read that and I thought, man, only 70 epidemiologists. That's probably more than you have in the whole public sector in all of sub-Saharan Africa. And there are literally billions of dollars of decision-making that ride on those early epi data, those estimates that I showed you, and yet they're fragile because our systems for our investment in strategic information across the world is so limited. It's very strong in the United States. It's very weak in much of the rest of the world. WHO publishes an annual report on our progress towards universal access, the first one published last April, next one coming out in May, covering these various health sector related issues, and I hope I would urge you to try and look for it in May. I said I'd say something about exceptionalism. This, of course, is the late Jonathan Mann, who was WHO's first director of the Global AIDS Program. He started that in 1986. He was worked for CDC as the head of Projet SIDA, the first international research site in Kinshasa. I don't know if younger people here know much about him. He was, of course, an exemplary, an extraordinary leader, a visionary, remarkably eloquent, and he died. It's 10 years ago this year that he died in a plane crash between New York and Geneva. Ron Baer, the sociologist from Columbia, coined the term AIDS exceptionalism, meaning referring to the different way that we deal with HIV or dealt with it over the years, particularly as regards named HIV reporting, which was for surveillance, the way we use HIV testing and so on, which has been quite different from other infectious diseases. And it just seems to me that a lot of this is moving on for a number of reasons. The advent of ART has made AIDS obviously different from what it was before. The enormous sums of money that are going into the global effort, the way that epidemiology has gone, the sort of stabilization of epidemiology, competing priorities and so on. So it's a dynamic situation. It remains a special disease. but it also has changed. There's three interesting, what I refer to as malignant arguments that are playing out right now, and we have to be extremely careful about them. One of them is skepticism around these estimates, because there have been reductions in the estimated number of infections several times. There's a kind of cynicism that different people have projected, even to the extent sometimes of claiming that actually there's manipulation going on for reasons of fundraising, which I really don't think is the case. A more important question than the absolute number is, have we given a reasonable description qualitatively of the epidemic and its trends? And I think we do have a reasonable understanding of that, and that, you know, whether it's 35 million, 30 million, or 28 million, it, you know, really, that doesn't matter. It's really, what does it mean and where's it going? A second malignant argument is this, that AIDS is now getting too much money compared to other diseases, and it's really not as bad as we thought, and it's taking care of itself, and so on. This was an article in the New York Times late last year, got reprinted in the Herald Tribune internationally. The author, who's actually a public health person from Harvard, says, last year the U.S. spent $3 billion on AIDS in Africa, invested only $30 million in traditional safe water projects. This nearly 100-to-1 imbalance is disastrously inequitable. Well, we could discuss that. I mean, it is disastrously inequitable, but I would argue that the thing to do is invest more in safe water. And then the third sort of really quite dominant argument is that the problem is health systems. Therefore, invest in health systems and stop this disease-specific approaches that are imbalancing health systems and actually making things worse. And these three arguments, I think, are a very serious set of forces for the AIDS community. I think activism has played a very important role in the history of the epidemic, and I think if we have the funding internationally that we now have and the access to therapy that literally 10 years ago I thought was an absolute pipe dream, I think activism has played a very important role in that. What I think activists could do today is focus more on prevention, focus more on HIV and tuberculosis, and get interested in the issue of health systems to get it right. And I think some of them are actually doing that, and this is actually, I think the rest of public health and medicine has actually learned quite a lot from the AIDS experience. So it's a very complicated environment that we're moving into. The president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, which I think deserves a lot of credit for what it's done, I'm always intrigued in that title, the emergency plan. As PEPFAR is now being reauthorized, what it needs to become is the sustainable plan for AIDS relief. And that implies a somewhat different set of thinking, but a commitment for the very long term. I've said enough about health systems. There is, 2010, which is the anticipated universal access date, it's around the corner. And I think that after that, the next big discussion, and it's already happening, is the Millennium Development Goals and the health-related MDGs 4 and 5, which, of course, 4 is related to child health and 5 to maternal health. The epidemiology has changed. This bipolar situation I described, I think, is more evident. There are competing threats, avian influenza, malaria is getting more money, et cetera, climate change, security. It's an extremely complicated environment internationally. The global health architecture, all these organizations and how they interact, and the Global Fund, which now has $10 billion to dispense over the next few years, it's not easy for a little organization like WHO to find its niche in all of this, and it continues to change all the time. So let me finish with this. This is the last slide. I think it applies to the virus. It applies. I urge you all to think about this in your own lives, and it certainly applies to individuals. It's not the strongest that survives, nor the most intelligent. It's the one that is most adaptable to change. I think organizations have to think of that as they find their way in this very complex environment. And That, of course, is Charles Darwin, and the fellow on the right is a West African drummer doing his best to be heard, and I sometimes think, you know, that reminds me somewhat of WHO. Thank you.
Kevin, thank you for an elegant and eloquent presentation. I was very pleased to see health systems mentioned a number of times in your presentation. We're looking at a PEPFAR reauthorization of between $30 and $50 million for the next 5 years. That's $10 billion a year. The House has already approved that. If you were Mark Dybul, the Global AIDS Coordinator, how would you strengthen systems through PEPFAR?
I think one of the things that has to happen, one of the things that concerns me about the health systems discussions is that they are very vague, and what needs to be brought to bear on them is specificity. So those six elements that are the essential components of a health system, human resources, infrastructure, et cetera, I think we really need to work at country level to try and strengthen each of these individually. And in Africa, I think human resources is a good place to start. And actually, I think I read somewhere that there's a possibility that that PEPFAR is going to fund some 100,000 or 120,000 healthcare workers. So, I mean, the specific elements of health systems, and not get bogged down in the academic debates about health systems that we've had for 20 years with so little impact. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. It's actually quite informative. I had a question about, as we look at sort of the impact of ARVs in Africa, particularly on children, and them sort of aging into adolescence now, but yet the sort of healthcare infrastructure isn't really geared towards them being anywhere, sort of in pediatric or sort of the adult world. Do you have a thought going forward how we sort of respond to this emergent population of adolescents and their sort of specific issues, both the perinatally infected kids as well as sort of this growing behaviorally infected population of adolescents?
I think you raise an important point. I don't think the population of young adolescents infected with HIV has been numerically that great, simply because of the very high mortality of children. Of course, young girls particularly are getting infected at a very early age, from about 14, 15 onwards. And you're right to point out this is we have done particularly badly for and with young girls and young women. I can't say much more than that. I think you're right to raise the point that in terms of care, this age group has its own specific requirements, and they have not been a priority. Yes?
What's the role of drug resistance and recombinant?
The role of drug resistance and recombinants. Well, recombinants clearly occur, and in some parts of the world, like in West Africa, they actually predominate. The West African epidemic is predominantly, if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, AG, I think. Recombinants certainly occur, and if you look at isolates from the DRC, which is probably the country that's been affected the longest, probably at an epidemic level. They have the most astonishing variety of different subtypes and recombinants. Drug resistance is going to be an inevitability. We know that from the experience with treatment in the industrialized world. Currently, it's probably, from the limited data available, it's probably not a very big issue yet, and certainly primarily transmitted drug resistance from a number of surveys in African countries seems to be rare. Yes.
Who are you
your presentation on issues of prevention, it seems to me like there is the context of socioeconomic and life reality factors that are not talked about adequately. And as much as the WHO has invested in micro-enterprise development in West Africa and its effect on reproductive health, as well as other parts of the world, there is much less that's being done directly in studying the change in life reality factors, employment. The slide that you presented about the train and the African men being displaced from one part of the world to the other, their world, isolated from their families and forced respond to their biological needs in ways that are dangerous. What are the efforts that are being done in terms of community development, micro-enterprise, and employment for men, and living standards for their families, and its impact on the epidemic? It's much easier for us to focus on the male genital organ and circumcising than to change the life of.
It's a very important question, and yet I don't think it has a satisfactory answer. And the response to AIDS since it was realized in the late 1980s that the response to AIDS had to be much broader than just a health sector response. And of course, it was that, apart from the typical human and organizational squabbling that went on about TERF, it was that, as much as anything else, that led to the creation of UNAIDS, which is the umbrella UN organization that brings together 10 different agencies dealing with different aspects of the epidemic. So your point, obviously, all of disease, particularly a complex, socially driven disease like this, all of it occurs in a social, economic context. On the other hand, it's also interesting that there's a lot of, obvious truths that when you actually look for data, do not seem to hold up. My own bio, wealth is health. And yet, if you look at HIV in Africa, you don't find that. Botswana, which has an economy that most African countries would can only dream of right now, is one of the most heavily affected countries in the world. In contrast, Niger, much poorer, is very little affected. If you look at, I believe in women's education. Paradoxically, women who are educated appear to be at higher risk for HIV in many different studies than women who are less educated. I believe in human rights, and yet countries like Afghanistan, which have the most horrendous rates of maternal mortality, have very little HIV compared to countries that are really quite progressive. And, time and time again, you sort of come up against these, apparent truths, and they don't really, when you look for data, it's not clear. And I guess that doesn't mean that those issues are not tremendously important for health in general, but I'd be careful about saying that's the answer to the AIDS epidemic. Because, ultimately, the problem with AIDS is, on the one hand, we have to be reductionist about it, because every transmission of HIV is a discordant event. It involves an infected person interacting, through blood or through sexual secretions with a negative person. Yet, that's simplistic. It's not easy, and the role of WHO is the health sector, and that, I think that the response to the epidemic has had to change, because we do have some interventions that at least stop people from dying. But to stop people from dying appears to be a lot easier than it is to stop them getting infected. Although I think our colleagues in tuberculosis actually are beginning to realize the same thing in some settings. That's not a very satisfactory answer, but it's a somewhat reductionist one.
We'll take one more.
Jim?
Wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Compound question. If we could transport you back 15 years,
knowledge you have now, what would you have done differently individually as part of the pop with this epidemic? What would you have had WHO do differently for its institutional role?
Well, the trouble is 15 years ago, we didn't have the interventions that we have now. So, I think, you know, I always, maybe make two or three comments, but I won't answer your question. you know, I think AR, the advent of ART really has fundamentally changed the world. I always say to people, you know, I think I've had a very privileged medical career, but I always say, you know, the single most extraordinary thing I've seen in my medical career was the emergence of the AIDS epidemic. I mean, being able to just watching this from the beginning is extraordinary. You couldn't dream it up. It's so extraordinary, you know. It's but then I say the second most important thing, the second most impressive thing, was the introduction of ART. I mean, to see people. You know, the way that you saw AIDS patients in the, you know, 80s and 90s, advanced HIV disease, people literally wasting away, to see therapy impacting on that is absolutely astonishing. I mean, it's you know, you wouldn't believe it if it was described to you. So I think those two things are remarkable. I've two other comments. I often ask people, and in a way, actually, this would be a very good question to set students in a school of public health. What would you do in the United States if we had a Swaziland-type epidemic? I mean, if 30% of Atlanta, New York, was infected, and, you know, health professors were dying, and healthcare workers died, and et cetera, you know, you'd lost two or three decades of life expectancy, and you could do anything you wanted to. What would you do? It's actually it's an important question. I think we'd do all sorts. I think we would have a emergency public health response that would be massive. It would incorporate testing at regular parts of life. It would probably involve individual counseling and support and care for every infected person, with ways of ensuring people did not transmit, etc., etc. It's an interesting discussion. And in a way, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is it the sort of, how do we explain the laissez-faire attitude about Africa? I'm not saying we have, but it's a question. Have we allowed a situation that actually we would never allow in our own country? And we've done it. What's interesting is we've done it sometimes in the name of human rights. Can't test people if they don't want to be tested, you know. Again, I mean, I agree with that. We shouldn't be forcibly testing people. But if there's one missed opportunity, I think when history looks back on all this, I do think that the way we have used the HIV test will be considered unwise in retrospect. I don't want to elaborate on, you know, how aggressively we should have used it, but for the control, I always say, you know, the laws of infectious disease epidemiology are as rigid as the laws of physics. And I think in infectious diseases, a diagnostic test for a disease for which you don't have a vaccine is a very important tool, and you need to use it wisely.
We'll get you back next year to talk about that. Please join us. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing all of you later this month for our next Grand Round series. Thanks so much for being here. Before you bug off.